Welcome to episode 273 of the Microsoft Cloud IT Pro Podcast, recorded live on March 11, 2022. This is a show about Microsoft 365 and Azure from the perspective of IT pros and end users, where we discuss the topic or recent news and how it relates to you. Today, we continue with the theme of cloud news as we talk about more recent announcements around Microsoft 365 and Azure. Today's topics include on-demand capacity reservations for Azure virtual machines and how they can be leveraged with site recovery, as well as CIS benchmarks for Azure Kubernetes service. We're just doing another news episode today, right? We talked about the whole Intune. I forgot the Intune autopilot request. We will have to loop back to that one because I can definitely talk about that, but I was not prepared today.
Look at you using the Microsoft lingo. Did you ACK that request and are you looped in on that conversation? And we'll have to double click on that later.
I will never use, we will have to double click down into that ever. If you ever catch, if anybody ever catches me saying, let's double click into that, slap me.
You'd be surprised. There's lots of things that I thought I would never say. And after 2 years at Microsoft, I tend to use them just because they're used by everybody else.
Do you use the double click one?
Double click, ACK, here is something that's orthogonal to something else. Certainly loop in. Oh yeah. Yeah. There's a lot of that.
Is loop in though really that much? Is that one Microsoft lingo? I feel like that one is a little more generic.
I feel like I never used it any place else as much as I do at Microsoft. Let me loop you into that conversation. Can I be looped into that conversation?
Only with Microsoft Loop. Will Microsoft Loop be able to loop you in?
I don't know. Maybe that's what they were thinking when they put it out there, but who knows?
Except that it's not very collaborative. It's more like Microsoft Live Edits.
Well, you're salty today. All right. Anyway, let's get started. Where do we start?
Before we digress too far. So since we were talking about, I don't know, web apps, account switchers. Let's talk about account switchers.
Account switchers, yes. So this is something that impacts Microsoft 365.
It is. So there's a roadmap ID for this one. Roadmap ID... something, something, 70801. Users can now sign into multiple work and personal accounts on Microsoft 365 web apps in the same browser. It also allows them to seamlessly switch between the accounts without having to sign out and sign back in again. So this means that if you're in Office 365 in certain apps, this is not coming to all apps. You'll be able to click like your little picture icon. And I am assuming that in this dropdown now, based on screenshots and what people say, that you will be able to show multiple Office 365 accounts there and just pick which one you want to use. Similar to what Azure does. Like Azure already has this.
Yeah, it'll be very similar to that.
It's like they're built on the same identity.
Probably just as annoying. I don't know if anybody's taken a look at the changes that have come out. If you're in a multi-tenant environment where you're switching back and forth between multiple tenancies, Azure ADs that are associated with N and Azure subscriptions, the new account switcher is not fun. And there used to be a feature flag where you could go ahead and append an initial query string to the URL and turn off the new experience. But now you can't do that anymore. So we are all stuck with the new one. But I think the one nice thing about the new one, like thinking to the way the Azure one works, is you can do account switching with not only organizational IDs, but also MSAs, which is kind of nice. So you can mix and match. Like if you had, you know, your regular MSA over in maybe like your MSDN subscription, but then you've got your org ID over here, you know, in your case, working across customer tenancies, I imagine you kind of rack up a collection of org IDs and multiple profiles in Edge or Chrome or Firefox or whatever you're using. So your life might get a little bit easier with something like this too.
I was just counting 12, 13, 14, 15, 16, 17, 18, 19, 20, 21. I have 21 profiles in Edge with 21 different Office 365 IDs. Like each profile is specifically because of Office 365 IDs. So if I can actually sign into like 21 different ones, so I have mixed feelings on if this is actually going to make it easier or not. Because now the problem is, right, as I'm in SharePoint, I'm working on something for a client. I jump over their org ID. And if I have something up in another window or another tab that's into my ID, what I have noticed is browsers start getting really confused when you have multiple tabs and you switch one of them to a new ID and then you go back to the other one and all of a sudden it doesn't know which ID you're logged in with.
Yeah, that's definitely an issue with this. If you're flipping back and forth, you're in the same browser profile, but you have different tabs and you're expecting the ability to be in different accounts and different tabs, that's not what this is. Like, you'll still need to maintain multiple profiles. Sometimes multiple profiles is easier too. Like, living that multi-browser, multi-profile life, like, it's not too bad, especially once you start to get a handle on, oh, I don't actually have to use the profile switcher. Like, in the case of Edge, you don't have to use the profile switcher to switch between profiles. If you're on, you know, a Mac or Windows, you can actually launch straight into that profile from its own icon on your dock or your taskbar. I do that a lot, particularly on devices that are like work/personal. You know, make those kind of quick launch buttons to go into each of those and keep them separate that way. I think the other thing you have to think of is when this comes out, it's not going to be available for everything. So it'll be helpful for certain scenarios, but not for all. So like portal.office.com, or I guess office.com now that it's all redirected over there, that'll be covered. ODB, OneDrive for Business, ODB for B, OneDrive Consumer, because you've got coverage for MSAs, the Outlook web app, because again, org ID and MSAs, Office web apps, same thing, SharePoint Online, and the Admin Center, kind of the first roll of it. And then later, you'll see support, hopefully, for Teams, Planner, Yammer. I think like Teams might be a big one for me, where I would actually like to have those kind of multiple org IDs going, even if I was going to combine them within a single browser.
Yeah.
Because I go back with trials and tribulations over whether I should run the Teams client and live with the pain that that brings me, or whether I should just run it in a browser and live with all the pain that that brings me.
Either way, it's going to bring you pain. And I see, so there's lots of comments in Discord about this. This has spurred quite the discussion. And one of the ones that was brought up is kind of what you said, like having this with the Office apps, and in particular, the Teams app, that's where I'd want to see this, because I very much have your pain. And I was doing training this past week. Perfect example, doing training this week for a company I partner with. And when I'm doing training and it's like mics and cameras and all of that, I have found the browser causes me more pain from audio video perspective when I have to be on camera the whole time and all of that. Just doing like quick conversations, browsing files, browser's fine. I literally signed out, closed Teams, reopened it, signed in 20 times. I could not get Teams to switch to another user account, no matter what I did. I could click on different user accounts. I could click sign in as a different user and type in the user account. It would not. I've been rebooted. It would not let me switch to the account I wanted to be logged in with to teach. And part of this is like certain accounts are invited to certain guest tenants. So I kind of need to be in that account. Finally, I said, forget it. I signed in the browser. I then joined it from my user and I like let myself into the meeting just so I could use the Teams desktop app. But being able to switch back and forth in the app itself would be way more beneficial to me than the browser.
I can see myself like Teams in a browser is probably my biggest one that I would use that for. And I would do a very unnatural thing where I would create a dedicated profile in Edge called Microsoft Teams. And then I would go sign into those 10 accounts there. And I would effectively turn that profile into an app that way and run it through. But yeah, I mean, it's on the radar. I think if you're an admin and you're working across tenancies, certainly having it available in things like the Admin Center is going to be super helpful. And, yep. And again, maybe that's one of those dedicated profile as an app thing rather than as a user thing and have a pretty unnatural kind of motion with it, but cheat your way through it till you're where you need to be.
Yeah, exactly. The thing that just blows me away about this is it's been in the iOS client for like over a year now, where you can do all of this in the iOS Teams client. It just doesn't work anywhere else.
Yeah, but then you want that to be on the desktop. You know, it's not the way it works.
Right. You only get it on mobile. Maybe I should just join all my meetings on my mobile device. Anyways, I will climb down off my soapbox now. This is coming. Again, I can see some scenarios will be helpful. I think the biggest thing is, one, how well it works. And two, the other thing is always the speed. Like, am I going to have to wait before? How long do I have to wait when I'm switching between it? Well, this may start to hit some of those requests that people have had about, especially Teams itself. Like, once it comes to Teams, having this work more like the way Slack does, where you can be signed into different organizations, different profiles, sign in once. I don't feel like it's going to get us to that point yet. Maybe it's the first step in that direction. I don't know. I'm torn on what I actually think about this and how much I'll actually use it.
Wow. Once it comes out, you can play with it a little bit more. But, you know, if you've been in Azure, it is there today. And I think it's going to be the same kind of experience from all the screenshots and everything that they've released so far.
Yep, I agree. And I do use it in Azure. So anyways, on to other news.
On to other news. You want to stick in Azure for a little bit?
Well, technically that was Microsoft 365.
I feel like you're loopy enough and you haven't had enough sleep that we can really like throw you for a loop today.
Oh, you can absolutely throw me for a loop today.
All right, let's talk about recovery services for a little while.
Oh, you already threw me for a loop, and it's just going to keep throwing me for a loop.
Do you feel overwhelmed by trying to manage your Office 365 environment? Are you facing unexpected issues that disrupt your company's productivity? IntelliJink is here to help. Much like you take your car to the mechanic that has specialized knowledge on how to best keep your car running, IntelliJink helps you with your Microsoft Cloud environment because that's their expertise. IntelliJink keeps up with the latest updates in the Microsoft Cloud to help keep your business running smoothly and ahead of the curve. Whether you are a small organization with just a few users up to an organization of several thousand employees, they want to partner with you to implement and administer your Microsoft Cloud technology. Visit them at IntelliJink.com/podcast. That's IntelliJink.com/podcast for more information or to schedule a 30-minute call to get started with them today. Remember, IntelliJink focuses on the Microsoft Cloud so you can focus on your business.
Okay, recovery services. What about recovery services?
There's this new capability that's out in preview. It's actually been out for a little while, but I don't know how many folks kind of caught on to it being out there, at least like when it was announced. So there's this thing called on-demand capacity reservations. Are you familiar with these? So they're on-demand capacity reservations for virtual machines.
I have heard of these. These are one I haven't spent a ton of time looking at in terms of all the benefits that come with them.
Yeah. So it's a capacity reservation that it's still attached to compute capacity, just like a kind of reserved instance would be along the way. So, you know, it's allowing you to do compute capacity requirements outside of the VMs themselves by like turning them on and having them always allocated. So I think there's a couple kind of key differences maybe to keep in the back of your head when you're thinking capacity reservations and virtual machine instances through traditional reservations. They both apply to virtual machines, but where RIs, they have that 1 or 3 year term. So you would say, hey, I'm doing a D series or an L series or even like a specific sub SKU of a series in a given region. You know, you would come in and you would purchase that in a 1 or 3 year increment. And then that potentially comes with, you know, discounts for purchasing a reservation because you're saying, I'm potentially going to allocate and use this compute ahead of time. You're locked into that term across the RI. With on-demand capacity reservations, there's no commitment at all. So you can just go ahead and create one of these. You can stand it up. You can tear it down at any time. You don't really worry about the how many, you know, of these did I accidentally purchase? Have I restocked too many for the year? Am I going to be able to get a credit on all of it? Like that all kind of goes away. And the other kind of key difference is when you buy RIs, your capacity, it's not reserved for you. So it's in your best interest if you're buying RIs because you get the discount associated with it that usually you're going to buy them for workloads that are fairly steady state, like they're on all the time or they're on the majority of the day, those kinds of things. But you know, I think something that folks kind of maybe forget in the back of their head is that capacity is not reserved. It's prioritized, but not guaranteed. But with an on-demand capacity reservation, your capacity is reserved, it's set aside, and it's backed by an SLA, or at least it'll be backed by an SLA once these things come out of preview, because previews don't carry SLAs. You got to wait for them to GA and all that kind of stuff. You end up in this model where RIs, you purchase in that 1 or 3 year term, you get the discounted reservation rate, but your capacity isn't actually reserved. You know, it should be there, it might be there, but it's not guaranteed. With these on-demand capacity reservations, you've got no commitment, no term, anything like that. Your capacity is reserved, it's set aside, and it will be backed by an SLA when it GAs. But when it comes to discounts, you don't get a discount. It's all just pay-go rates.
So, and it looks like, I was just looking through this, capacity reservations, because you're paying for capacity or guaranteed capacity, even though the VM may be deprovisioned, you're still getting billed like it's on because you're essentially saying, I want to buy these resources. And whether I'm using them or not, I'm going to pay for them because I want to know that when I go to spin up this VM, those resources are going to be there.
Yes. Yeah. In and of itself, that's kind of a cool capability, or it's something nice to have in your back pocket if you need it, depending on your workload and how you're trying to stand that up. If you're trying to do like a true kind of hot, warm scenario, generally you're going to want that stuff to be there and available for you if you do ever have to kind of spin up warm and get it hot really quick. Yep. Or if you think you're doing kind of like a passive hot kind of thing, it's nice to have it there. But where this starts to get really interesting is now you can, and the new part of this, so on-demand capacity reservations, they were announced months ago, I think like last year before Ignite, and they've kind of been kicking around in preview. But this week out in preview, they announced that you can leverage on-demand capacity reservations with Azure Site Recovery. So you can tie a capacity reservation group into virtual machines that are managed within a recovery services vault. And now for these kind of failover scenarios where, you know, you are doing that active warm, or really you're doing like a hot cold kind of thing, and you want to be able to go to hot really quick and have guaranteed compute, you can combine those two capabilities together. And when you fail over, because you're associated with a capacity reservation, your compute is guaranteed for you on the other side. And that is all very good and nifty.
So the comment to sum all of that up in the chat is you can pay for a hot spin up for DR.
Yes, if you want to go that way and leverage it with a recovery services vault. So now you can kind of leverage cross-region recovery with guaranteed compute.
That can definitely be helpful. I can see, again, like you said, clients that need to be guaranteed, or customers of Azure that need to be guaranteed, that is probably worth it.
Yeah, if you're looking for that capability. You know, there's some comments in the chat like, that's going to be expensive. Yes, it will be, but it's something that a lot of customers look for as well. And I think once this GAs and you start to get that SLA combined with from your capacity reservations on top of what recovery services gets you, you'll start to get locked into SLAs around RTO with recovery services, which is also good for you. Like, you can take that as you can take that RTO that's tied to that SLA, and you can drive that back into SLAs that you offer within your business, or you start to incorporate those SLAs directly into how you architect your cloud deployments, like if they are compute-based and built on top of VMs.
Yeah, or even if you're offering software, some service that you've built, customers are buying it from you, that SLA can help from that perspective too. And I see it, again, going back to the pay, like, yeah, you're going to pay for it. But you look at some of the numbers about the amount of money certain companies lose when there's an outage. And just think, like, if you had an outage and you went to go spin up your backups and you couldn't do it because there wasn't capacity, this very easily could pay for itself in some of those scenarios.
I think the other place where, you know, I can see a lot of customers using it is I've been on kind of a number of projects over the last couple of years where we've worked with customers who have kind of gone the route of ditching as much of their on-premises footprint as they can, particularly when it comes to having their own DCs. Like, it's really tight out there right now in the supply chain if you're trying to buy disks. Like, I don't know if anybody's gone and tried to buy like a new pizza box from Dell, but shipping times are not pretty for anything. Like, all the capacity has been eaten up by kind of these, you know, super compute providers, right? You've got Microsoft out there, AWS, Google hasn't stopped buying compute and along the entire way. You've got Apple, Facebook. Like, there's some really big players out there that they eat up a lot of the supply chain. And when the supply chain gets restricted like this, it makes it really hard for some businesses to be able to kind of maintain and keep going like that. So if you're used to having two DCs on premises and being able to fail over between those and manage those workloads that way, you're starting to get that same kind of capability up in the cloud as well. With you know, maybe a better RTO, maybe a worse RTO, like depending on how you ran your business, but certainly having the SLA and everything around it that, you know, you can carry back.
Yeah, and this is just VMs. I'm trying to think. I mean, I guess maybe this could come to things like Azure SQL or SQL MI or some of those. But for now, this is just virtual machines, and it is just certain series. Only AV2, BDEF VM series are supported during this preview period.
Yeah. Yeah, it's in preview. There's a bunch of kind of limits and restrictions. So they're all documented. It is there, ready to go. So yeah. I thought that was kind of a cool one to have stood up and hanging out.
That is. So in other news, when I'll stick in Azure, and I'm trying to avoid letting you go into your next topic. Logic apps, Azure Logic apps, availability zone support is coming for Azure Logic apps. Did you see this one?
Yes. I think over time you'll see availability zone support for
just about all anything.
Things. Yeah.
Yeah. This was just, again, we don't need to spend a lot of time on this, but this is going to be for both consumption-based and standard-based Logic apps, where essentially those workflow executions, those Logic app plans will get distributed across three different zones in an Azure region so that if there is one of those outages, you'll have some of that redundancy in place so that your Logic apps will continue to fire. IP addresses will change. So some of the endpoint for inbound and outbound IP addresses, so if you're using firewalls, that will come into play if you're doing like some type of blocking, limiting based on IP address endpoints. Other than that, there's not really a whole lot you have to do for this other than they're going to start having that added, the words are escaping me. They're going to have that added redundancy, that added uptime that you'd get from availability zones.
Added redundancy, added durability, all those kinds of things. Yeah. Yeah. So if you look at the way new regions have launched, you know, I can't recall seeing a new region that's launched in a long time that doesn't have AZs. Like, it's just the default state, and I think what customers expect. And you've also seen a lot of retrofit of AZs to existing regions as well that hadn't had them in the past as those kind of build outs complete. So you're kind of approaching the point where availability zones by default is an option that's available to you and a pretty good way to live your life.
Sounds good.
Should you want to pay to play, because, you know, they typically cost more money than just single zone kind of things.
If you use more resources, it costs more.
It does. yeah, we're back to that.
Anyways, it's Friday. How dare that logic apply, Scott?
Yeah, indeed. How dare it?
Comments from the Peanut Gallery live on Discord. Do you want to dive into your other... Do I dare let you dive into your other Azure services, your backup vault news topic?
I don't think you do. We should save that one for another day. We could probably do that as a dedicated thing.
That one hurt my brain.
Well, that's good to hear. But we can certainly talk about more Azure stuff. Are you familiar with CIS benchmarks?
Yes.
Yes. So lots of customers look for these, and quite often you are maybe left in a lurch when you have to implement a Center for Internet Security benchmark on top of cloud services, especially in Azure. Like, that was always my experience with them, was you could go out and find a CIS benchmark for AWS, and then you'd come back over to the Azure side for an equivalent service, and you'd go like, huh, I kind of got to like make that up on my own and see what I can retrofit in. And over time, like, it was that way for years, but over the last 2 years, like, that gap has really started to close, and more services within Azure have adherence to, or at least guidance around, specific versions of CIS benchmarks. So the latest one that I saw that just popped in recently was AKS, Azure Kubernetes Service. So they now have a set of scored recommendations against the V1.0.0 benchmark. So if you're running AKS V1.2.0 or higher, and you're looking for a CIS benchmark, that all exists for you. You don't have to make it up on your own anymore.
So do those all... I was looking, because they have the Azure Security Baseline for AKS, but that is not necessarily aligning with the CIS benchmarks?
Correct. That's a different kind of thing.
Oh, there's the link. Now you posted it. Are these built into the Security Advisor?
I don't know that they are. Like, not every customer needs to run with like a CIS benchmark. It's still, I think, a specific use case. You don't have every customer coming in and saying like, oh my gosh, I must meet CIS benchmark 1.0.0.
Like, right. I feel
okay, that's a little bit of a unique requirement.
Yeah, I tend to run into the CIS benchmarks more when it's a customer dealing with some type of government contract, is when CIS benchmarks seem to pop up more frequently.
You'll see them there, or you'll see them just in like competes against AWS. Like, somebody will throw in an RFP, like, must blah, 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 CIS. And you're like, oh, I know why you did that, because you wanted to disqualify a vendor or something like that. So it starts to knock some of that down. Financial services is another one. FSI definitely pops up there.
Yeah, I'm still waiting. I think we talked about this. We may have talked about this a few weeks ago. I'm still waiting for CIS benchmarks to show up in Office 365 for like Intune device management type stuff. Being able to apply the recommendations from CIS benchmarks to devices you enroll in Intune. But we can save that for Intune episode.
Have you put out a feature request on, what do they call it? Ideas? I don't know what they call it for the Microsoft 365 thing.
I don't know either.
Like, we've got feedback.azure.com, but I always forget the new one for Microsoft 365.
Maybe it's feedback.office.com. Office. I saw it recently. Nope. Feedback.office.com. DNS probe failed. Yeah. Anyways, so another one. This is just a fun article to wrap it up with. I have not read this. There's not a lot in here. There was a recent article that came out about the anatomy of a data center, how Microsoft's data center hardware powers the Microsoft cloud. So just kind of a fun, again, it's not crazy in depth, so don't go out and think you're going to get all the proprietary secrets of the data centers. It's a pretty short read, but it just, that always fascinates me. I think we talked about this once too, probably not on the podcast, but, or if anybody's listening from Microsoft and can get me in a data center, I would love to get some type of tour of a Microsoft data center sometime.
We don't need to have offices anymore. You know, like, I think you sit here and you see me in the same exact spot week after week. So nobody's going anywhere. You might as well pretend data centers are just somebody else's server under a desk over there.
There's somebody else's server. I think I still have that sticker. My other computer is an Azure data center. Picked that up at Ignite a few years back.
If anybody is interested in Azure data center design, how we've built them, what goes into them, I would recommend, I'll put a link in the show notes to a talk that Mark Rusinovich gives. And he usually does this kind of talk as internal employees at some of the internal events. But he did a version for externals as well. So it doesn't have all the nitty-gritty, but I think it's a decent introduction to how we're designing, how we're thinking about building things out, how sustainability comes into play there, how we think about things like carbon offsets in our design. Like, there's a lot of that. So it's a session that's called Inside Azure Data Center Architecture with Mark Rusinovich, and it's on the YouTubes. I will put a link in the show notes for it.
All right. Sounds good. I'll have to go watch that. I remember hearing some of the Office 365 ones too, like the fact that they never patch an Exchange server. They just rip it out and put a new one in. So they never do they never do live updates of Exchange servers. They get new ones built up, stick the new ones in, rip the old ones out, and are always swapping servers like in and out of these clusters for some of these large environments so that they're never introducing changes on the servers running the live services. That was one of the Ignite talks. They talked about that.
Yeah. It's an interesting way to see how some of these are run. You know, there's parts of the footprint where you go out. Anybody who's familiar with Microsoft, like, you've probably seen some of the marketing materials or call outs around data centers where, you know, we have some data centers that run completely outdoors, like they're shipping containers that are just dropped on a concrete pads. But you've got hookups on them for HVAC, for networking, for power, all that. So you kind of get this just big shipping crate that gets dropped down and it has all the compute, all the network, everything's kind of pre-configured in it and ready to go. Like, you really don't open that up to swap out a blade, like if a motherboard burns out or something like that. You just wait until enough of them die and you go like, okay, that entire unit of compute, like that whole thing's coming out and we'll just drop a new one in. And you kind of rinse, repeat, and go from there.
Yeah, I can't imagine like functioning at that scale where you're like unplugging and plugging shipping containers into your data center, essentially.
Yeah, there's weird stuff. I think the other one, there's a couple other ones. So Microsoft has been fairly open with kind of experimental design around trying to get things to run in different environments. So somebody was mentioned in the chat, Dublin, North Europe, where they did the experiment for a couple of years where they effectively dropped sealed units of compute just into the ocean because you have a bunch of passive cooling from the ocean and potentially also power, right? Because just waves are rocking back and forth and you can capture that energy and drive it directly into the compute you drive. There's some interesting talks out there. Again, just like go search on YouTube for these kinds of things for the like the motherboards that live in liquid all the time. So, you know, effectively like a water-cooled PC, except the entire motherboard is in like a non-conductive, you know, medium that you can just drop it into and you can let it run. And, you know, eventually it's going to die, but, you know, when it dies, you just swap it out and go to the next thing.
Yeah, it is. Again, that type of stuff just fascinates me.
There's a bunch of it out there. The other cool one is, and it's not Microsoft specific, if you're kind of interested in custom compute design, things like that, more interesting ones I've seen in the past couple of years is you can go out and look at the way companies like Facebook are standing up their own custom compute. So how does somebody like Facebook, I think Google's done the same thing as well. How do they take and think about their internal businesses that they run and, you know, all the compute that powers the news feed in Facebook, right? Like that's all yep. A different custom design that they've spun up and they can run in their own data centers. And it's built to spec for the type of business that they're in. And it's performant for the things that they need it to be, which is a pretty nifty way to go about it. I forget what that stuff's called. If it's like the Open Compute Project or something like that, I'd have to go Google around a little bit.
Yeah, I can't remember either. But it's one of those things you don't often think about when you're not operating at that scale. Is even a lot of enterprises, it's still you buy a server, you rack them, stack them, all of that. But there's a lot of those data centers, Microsoft and their shipping containers and Google and Facebook and AWS. Like they're not just buying servers. They have all these custom built, fine-tuned, like they're not in cases. They're just motherboards shoved in custom designed enclosures. And yeah, all that wild stuff that companies at that scale get to do with their data centers.
It is a thing.
So anyways, we should caseless PC. You can have caseless PCs. Just set the motherboard on your desk.
I think that's like a couple Raspberry Pis that I have in the house that I've been too lazy to put inside their cases.
Kind of like I have one sitting right here on my desk.
That's what a caseless PC. Yeah. I'm just waiting to touch it one day when it's on and have it zap me, and that'll be it.
Yep. I have one playing with Home Assistant that's just sitting on my desk, not in a case, like hanging by the power cord. Yep, that type of scenario. Anyways, should probably wrap it up for today before...
Yeah, on to the next meeting.
Yeah, that's right. You have your standing meeting here coming up shortly. I have work to wrap up and deadlines to meet and all of that. So enjoy your day.
Sounds good.
Enjoy your weekend. Everybody in the chat, enjoy your weekend as well. And we will not be back next week. We will be at an odd time, right? Next week we had to reschedule.
Yes. I am taking a mandatory vacation that I've decided is mandatory for myself and my sanity. So next week we will not do a live show, but we'll still have our regular recording coming out.
Yep. Regular recording will come out, no live show next week. So enjoy your weekend, enjoy your weeks, and we will talk to everybody later.
Thanks, Ben.
If you enjoyed the podcast, go leave us a 5-star rating in iTunes. It helps to get the word out so more IT pros can learn about Office 365 and Azure. If you have any questions you want us to address on the show or feedback about the show, feel free to reach out via our website, Twitter, or Facebook. Thanks again for listening and have a great day.